You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Gervais.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Gervais. I'm the host of the show. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a healthy, sustainable world. A world where our food is free from GMOs and harmful chemicals, where our food is healthy and safe for our children, our grandchildren, and generations to come. If you share our vision, please go to our website and join us by subscribing to us. And please don't forget to confirm your email. We'd also like to thank bensound.com for our new intro and outro music.
Hi, it's Carol again. Do you drink almond milk? Do you know that packaged almond milk contains all sort of nasty additives like carrageenan and barely contains any actual almonds? The good news is that you can make fresh almond milk at home in minutes. Once you taste the creamy, fresh flavor of homemade almond milk, you'll never go back. I make my almond milk at home with a Nutiana nut milk bag. It's great, easy to use, easy to clean, and makes my almond milk silky smooth. In addition to nut and seed milks, you can use it for sprouting, making cold brew coffee, juicing, and more. Buy yours today by searching the Nutiana Nut Milk Bag on Amazon. That's Nutiana, Nut Milk Bag. Or go to Nutiana.com.
You're going to love this bag. I am so honored to have back on our show today Dr. Don Huber. Dr. Huber is a professor emeritus of plant pathology at Purdue University and is a graduate of the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College and Industrial College of the Armed Forces. He was serial pathologist at the University of Idaho for 8 years before joining the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology at Purdue University in 1971. His agricultural research the past 55 years has focused on the epidemiology and control of soil-borne plant pathogens. He retired in 1995 as Associate Director of the Armed Forces Medical Intelligence Center as a colonel after 41 years of active and reserve military service. He is an active scientific reviewer, consultant to academia, industry and government, an international research cooperative with projects in 11 countries as well as the U.S. He is the author or co-author of over 300 journal articles. And I am just so thrilled to introduce him today. I was recently in California with him at the National Heirloom Expo, where I moderated a panel with Dr. Huber and Zen Honeycutt and Dr. Robert Kramer. And we discuss GMOs and glyphosate on this panel discussion. And it never ceases to amaze me the wealth of knowledge this man brings us about glyphosate and GMOs.
Dr. Huber, welcome to Food Integrity Now.
Thanks, Carol. It's great to be with you.
Well, thanks for being on with us today. I know we spent a few days together at the National Heirloom Expo, and we had several conversations in addition to our panel discussion at this event. And I wanted to discuss some of the information you shared with me on this interview today, as well as some more current issues that seem really relevant. So let's first start out with GMOs and from a science perspective. What can you tell us about the process of genetic engineering?
Well, genetic engineering, as we practice it today, is based on fossil science. It's based on the concept that you have one gene that controls one function. We know that isn't the case. We threw out that whole concept of genetics pretty much about 50 years ago with the sequencing of the human genome, where we realized that it's not one gene, one function, but it's the spatial relationship between the genetic material and the influence of the environment that determines what is produced, so that one gene, quote-unquote, may actually be responsible for regulating the production of many different products depending on the environment and the interaction with other genes. So that as we look at genetic engineering as we practice it today, it's a very disruptive process and one that is probably described better as an infective process, similar to what you have with gene transfer, with virus infection, or with some bacterial or fungal infections, such as the tumor producing bacterium, Agrobacterium tumefaciens, where genetic material is transferred into the cell and you have the expression of that genetics, but it's nothing similar to what you would have with the genetic process. Now, the importance of recognizing that change in understanding of genetics is that even though we may have the expression of a particular trait with genetic engineering, we also know that there are many other products that are produced besides just that one product, whether it be the production of a very powerful insecticide, the BT toxins, or the EPSPS genetics that gives us Roundup Ready crops. So that in addition to that, there are many other processes or many other products that can be produced. Many of those are totally new to science. Now, if you'll hear in the propaganda machines that why we've had genetic engineering for 20 years and we've never had anything that any safety issues. That's not true. To start with, just in the process, there are millions of toxic reactions that kill the cells before they even get to the point of expressing a particular trait. And then we have the situation where we have the genetically engineered potato in England in 1998 that was being evaluated for safety, that within 10 days the rats were experiencing severe lung problems, kidney and liver failure, and other problems. So the government came in and locked the lab, fired RPAT, Pustai, and burned all of the materials. So we've never really been able to document what that toxic principle was in the genetically engineered potatoes, because each event in genetic engineering is completely unique. There are no two that are the same, because the genetic inserts can never be located in the same position. So you always have that spatial difference when you disrupt the integrity of the genetic code, and also then that influences or is affected by how the environment influences that expression. So in the potato, we don't know what that very lethal or very toxic entity is, because everything was destroyed. We do have the situation with the genetically engineered L-tryptophan, however, where this was being produced as a nutrient supplement, and in order to get the production a little more competitive for one of the companies, it decided to genetically engineer its bacteria that produced the L-tryptophan, an essential amino acid for animals and humans. And in that process, there was a totally new protein that was produced that turned out to be lethal. 80 people died, and 10,000 people now are permanently incapacitated as a result of consumption of that L-tryptophan that was a very highly purified product is 99.9% pure, but in that 0.1%, it had a new protein. Actually, there were 6 new proteins to humans, and consequently, a very devastating impact. Now, it took 12 years to identify that new compound because it was totally new, never been seen in science or nature before, but a new product produced as a result of the genetic engineering process itself. It's a 3-phenylaminodiamine that turned out to be the killer contaminant in that.
Dr. Huber, I remember when all this took place, and that was one of the first genetically engineered substances, if I'm correct, wasn't it?
On a broad-based exposure, yes. The other 6 companies making it that didn't use a genetic engineering process didn't have any problem, even though they did find some unique proteins from the bacteria that they were using. But they were all normal proteins, but in the one genetically engineered bacteria then, even though they were merely adding duplicate copies of the bacteria's own genes to produce more L-tryptophan, in that disruption of the integrity of the genetic code by those additional inserts is where they were getting the new products, lethal products that were produced. We can take that one step further with Dr. Shiva Ayyaderi's recent research, been published now from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, showing so when you disrupt the integrity of the genetic code, that you have a blockage of C1 metabolism. Well, C1 metabolism is the center or the basic metabolism that we have for building new compounds, adding carbon compounds. It's also a very critical pathway for detoxifying compounds that are normally produced during the metabolic cycle. One of those compounds is formaldehyde. So that, as Dr. Ayyaderi's group at Massachusetts Institute of Technology has shown, that when you disrupt the integrity of the genetic code, one of the things that happens is blockage of C1 metabolism for detoxifying formaldehyde. Now, formaldehyde is a normal metabolite, but it's normally almost instantaneously eliminated from the body or from a plant through that C1 metabolism. When that metabolism is blocked, then you have an accumulation of formaldehyde, a very toxic compound and category 1 carcinogen at very low levels. So that by blocking the C1 metabolism, we end up with a very powerful carcinogen then in our food. And there have been levels in corn, Roundup Ready corn or triple stack corn, for instance, that have been shown to be anywhere from 10 to 200 parts per million of formaldehyde. Well, if you realize that formaldehyde is one of the compounds that FEMA had to replace all of their trailers for, because there was formaldehyde coming out of the construction materials. The highest level of formaldehyde that they found in any of those trailers that people were living in that were causing asthma and allergy responses and rashes, a number of other health problems, The highest level that FEMA found was 0.097 parts per million. And here in our genetically engineered corn and also soybeans, we find anywhere from 10 to 200 parts per million. Again, it's a class category 1 carcinogen, very well documented in that health aspect. But along, as Shiva and his group have shown then, along with the increase in accumulation of formaldehyde, you also have a depletion in glutathione, which is your body's defense mechanism, the highly, very powerful antioxidant there. So that from a health standpoint, we get clobbered both ways. It shuts down the immune system, and it builds up a natural toxicant that is an extreme carcinogen and bactericide. So that when people say, well, there aren't any documented health aspects to genetic engineering process, it's just not true. There are numerous documented peer-reviewed scientific studies that document the presence of very toxic compounds, and again, some of them totally new to science that we have no real idea of what their toxicity is because we've never seen them before. They're not natural products or normal products of metabolism. So when we're evaluating genetically engineered plants or the process, we really have to recognize that there are two components to that evaluation. One is the genetic engineering process itself that gives us toxic products, either the potent insecticide, the Cry-1A toxins, insecticides that are going to be present in our food then, as well as the chemicals that we're applying to those plants for as herbicides, the glyphosate or 2,4-D or dicamba, other materials there that are now engineered tolerance into the plant. But we also have to look at the natural products then that are toxins that accumulate. And so it's both of those systems that need to be evaluated that haven't been effectively evaluated in the scientific community because these are proprietary products that our scientists are prohibited from doing the necessary safety studies on.
Let's talk about glyphosate, which 80 to 85% of the crops that are genetically engineered are engineered to withstand huge doses of glyphosate. Let's talk about some of the things that we know about glyphosate as far as chelation and endocrine disruption. And can you explain some of that to us?
Surely. Glyphosate was first patented as a strong mineral chelator in 1964. It was patented as, or its use primarily was in cleaning boilers and steam pipes because of its strong chelating ability with calcium and magnesium and iron and other minerals. So it was a good descaler. 10 years later, then, Monsanto patented as a very powerful herbicide, broad spectrum, that killed almost all plant life, again, because it's a strong chelator. The essential minerals serve not only as part of the plant, or part of our bodies, but they also serve as a regulatory mechanism for most of our enzyme systems, so that they're the cofactors or the key that turn on and off these powerful enzymes that do the work. In that chelating process, they can immobilize those nutrients then and shut down physiological processes. That's essentially how all of our weed killers, our herbicides, really work, is by immobilizing the weed killers will chelate with the mineral to make it unavailable for a particular enzyme system. And that system then is shut down because the mineral is the key or the cofactor for that enzyme is no longer available for to turn it on. In addition to its chelating effects, glyphosate has also been patented by Monsanto as a very powerful broad-spectrum antibiotic. It's an antibiotic against the good guys primarily. It takes about 4,000 times the concentration of glyphosate that it would take to kill your beneficial microorganisms in your GI tract, for instance, to have any toxicity against many of the pathogens that we worry about. So in that antibiotic role, we see it changing the soil biology because we rely on many of those soil organisms to increase our nutrient availability and to produce many of the compounds, some of the hormones and that the plant needs and that we also need. So glyphosate is toxic to those organisms in the soil, but it stimulates the soil-borne plant pathogens. It also stimulates some human pathogens so that it increases our vulnerability if we're consuming glyphosate. Its biggest effect, though, on animals and humans is its antibiotic effect and its chelation, immobilization of essential minerals that we need. We end up with a process that we call gut dysbiosis or disruption of our general GI tract microflora, microorganisms that we rely on for neural health, for brain function, for immunity and resistance, and all of those things. So glyphosate's a very powerful, unique compound because of its many interacting factors in both the body and the environment.
Well, let's talk about one of those minerals that is very important to us, which is manganese.
Well, manganese is essential for about 28 enzymes. So in the body, it has, it's not just one pathway that's affected. In the plant, if it wasn't for manganese, none of us would be here because manganese is involved in that water splitting reaction that gives us oxygen. In photosynthesis is where we get our oxygen for breathing. The plant gets the hydrogen then to combine with carbon dioxide from the air to form the sugar. But in the body, manganese is involved in about 28 enzymes as the regulatory entity there, everything from sugar metabolism and that to fertility and hormone function and systems. So if you're deficient in manganese, you're struggling in many different areas because of those different physiological pathways that are impacted. Now, what we see with manganese deficiency is infertility, stillbirths. You'll see malformed fetuses. In calves, you'll see they have kind of a knobby joint because without manganese, you can't move calcium into the bone structure. And so a calf can look just like it has severe arthritis under a manganese deficient situation. And we see that very common now. We see it also in humans. And it's one of the factors that is probably involved in a lot of our miscarriage and stillbirths that we see all too common now.
Yeah, when we were together in California, you spoke about some of the research you're currently working on regarding glyphosate and infertility. Can you talk with us a little bit about what you're working on and some of the findings?
Yes, actually, Dr. Jeffrey Sheffers, a veterinary pathologist at the University of Minnesota, has published on the infertility in animals, in cattle especially, showing that all of those stillbirths are extremely deficient in manganese. But there's another aspect to it, and this is one that we're still trying to get our handle on it, and that's a new entity that we see associated with a lot of our severe plant diseases and also with some of the human diseases that are associated with it, again, especially infertility or miscarriage, where you'll see this entity always present in those tissues that have been aborted on it. So the interest here, or the aspect that we're trying to look at, is going back with the situation we have with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans, or mad cow disease in animals, as it's referred to. We have an epidemic of wasting disease in many states now in animals, in deer and elk, that are referred to as prion-type diseases. The prion is a natural protein that is a metalloprotein. In other words, there's a metal element that is associated with that protein that stabilizes it, or in some aspects or some theories that the protein is actually the detoxifying entity for the metal, such as copper, or as you see with in the brain with the Creutzfeldt-Jakob or mad cow disease. It's a copper metalloprotein that's there. And if you go back to Purdy's hypothesis in England, an authority on mad cow disease, he had proposed that it, and research that showed some interesting evidence that it was the application of an organic phosphate insecticide that was associated with the mad cow disease, with the folding of this normal protein. And his idea is, he showed in his research, that as you chelate the copper with this very strong chelator, phosmet insecticide, that copper then, in being removed, is replaced by manganese. So you have an excess manganese there that brings about the folding of the protein. Now, we don't have all of the information we need in this regard, but certainly glyphosate is a very powerful chelator for both copper and manganese. The chelating stability constant is about 100 times more powerful for copper than it is for manganese, so you could have an exchange in that area to predispose to some of these other types of conditions. We do see that entity always present in much higher concentrations in our genetically engineered plants than we see it in our non-GMO. So the areas that we're trying to follow up on to see if it's just a correlation or if there's a true causal relationship. And the primary associations that we're finding are the increased plant diseases as a reason for seeing new symptoms now that we used to didn't see for some of these diseases, but also then the correlation with miscarriage and infertility in animals.
Well, in humans, there certainly is an increase in infertility. Definitely, there's been an increase, and also in miscarriages. It makes one wonder why.
Yeah, well, you see a 30% drop in fertility in our population in just the last 5 years. So we know something's going on, and this is one of those entities that is correlated and associated with it, that again, we have a little ways to go to identify whether that's a causative relationship or a correlation. We know that when we remove it from the body, that it can restore fertility.
Wow, that is fascinating. This research that you're doing with others, this could be potentially kind of open a whole new can of worms, so to speak, for the biotech industry if it's conclusive.
Yes, well, it would indicate that some of those new products, new proteins and new products that are produced, and the change in environment that's brought about by the strong chelator certainly have more effects than just the one that's being measured for resistance to or tolerance to the herbicide.
Dr. Huber, can you talk about what happened with the 46 million birds that died? I thought this was really interesting.
Well, we've had a tremendous epidemic of bird flu. USDA made the comment, or one of the USDA researchers said, this is really an interesting strain of bird flu because it isn't attacking the free-range birds and their organic-fed birds. Now, I don't know of any virus that knows the difference between an organically fed turkey or chicken or one that's out on free range to be that selective. But it is, and if you look at it, there's several reasons why. One is that there's a difference in nutrition in a free range and an organic fed bird, so that their immune system is probably better. And you also see then the compromise of the resistance as Dr. Ariadere has shown, when you're feeding genetically engineered feed, you have that accumulated formaldehyde that's being consumed, and along with that you have a depletion of glutathione. So you predispose the animal to disease. You might say it's kind of like giving the animal a bad case of AIDS. It's not the AIDS that kills them. It's the virus then that does it. There could be other factors that are involved, because in the genetically engineered plant, you also have all of the viral promoter genes that from the genetic engineering process. So you have the CAM35S promoter genes. Those are the virulence genes for viruses. That's how they get the expression of the genetic material that they want when they're inserting the EPSPS for Roundup Ready characteristics. So while they're inserting their traited genetics, they also have to insert the virulence genes for the virus or for a virus to get those genes expressed. Well, when the animals then are consuming that, they would also be taking in those that genetic material that would increase virus resistance or virus susceptibility. So a weak virus could become very serious then with the presence of the CAM35S promoter genes. So there are a number of changes that are possible or that do occur that could possibly have an influence on increased susceptibility. You have a reduced mineral availability in many of those genetically engineered feeds, so that would also compromise the animal's resistance mechanisms. It's, again, it's not just one gene, one trait. You have a whole group of genes that you're throwing into that to disrupt the integrity of the genetic code that could all work to increase the susceptibility to some otherwise pretty benign diseases.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
But when you look at the bird flu situation, that's 46 million birds that have been euthanized. Again, the only organic ones that I'm aware of are the ones that got caught in a 3.5 mile radius from an infected regular herd, commercial herd, and were euthanized not because they had the flu, but because they were in that 3.5 mile radius. To my knowledge, no organic and no free range have come down with the bird flu.
Well, there certainly seems like there's some correlation there. Let's move on to talk about something that's very, very current and something I feel is very important. Let's talk about labeling. I know you're working in Idaho to get labeling in your state, but you're also involved with the Republican caucus and drafting a bill in case H.R. 1599 is passed in the Senate next month. Can you speak a little about that?
I think H.R. 1599, the DARK Act, or they call it the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act, is just another manifestation of the deception that we've had in this whole process of genetic engineering. The whole bill I personally believe, is unconstitutional because it penalizes free speech. Violates the First Amendment, and it also not just prohibits free speech, but it penalizes free speech, because if you want to label as non-GMO, even voluntarily, you can only do that with approval of the FDA and paying a fee or a tax, however you want to look at it, in order to state that your commodity doesn't contain genetically engineered components. There's no such requirement on any of those manufacturers or suppliers that would have the genetically engineered product components in them. So it's a very discriminatory bill. It's a bill just to preempt state GMO disclosure laws. And as I've told our representatives here in Idaho, it's a disgrace to have your name associated with it.
What are you working on in case this does get passed?
Well, I'm continuing to do all I can to educate.
To show
that this, we don't have established safety on this process. We don't even understand the process fully. It's a new era of science, and for the most part, we're working in the dark ages. I told my professional society when they endorsed genetic engineering that it was like being encompassed in the Flat Earth Society all over again. That we know that the concepts are no longer valid. They worked well for us with Mendelian genetics to get a handle on what was happening, but we know that they're not valid from a scientific standpoint. And yet we continue to promote them. We continue to ignore the fact that we have a serious deterioration of health in the United States that is only comparable to other countries that have adopted GMO crops and the excessive use and abuse of many of these chemicals. Because when the plant can tolerate the chemical without being killed, then we've seen our rates of glyphosate, for instance, increase as much as 15-fold, not 15%, but 15-fold. So you see all of those promises of genetic engineering to solve our problems and our high pesticide usage are all failed promises because it's based on a flawed science.
Yes. And I saw in the news today that Australia and Italy are both requesting opt-outs from growing the 8 varieties of GM maize. And thus there'll be really a full ban on GM crops in both these countries. So that was some good news.
Yes, we're seeing that list of countries increase. And my concern is that we'll keep our head in the sand and it will have a tremendous negative impact on our agricultural economy because we overproduce and need that agricultural export for part of our balance of payments. And if we're no longer producing to meet the requirements of our customers, they're going to find other sources for those commodities. We see that with China and their outreach to Australia now to produce non-GMO soybeans. We see the growing list of areas in Brazil that now are growing non-GMO soybeans, and they're guaranteeing zero contamination. So they're listening to the customer. Our approach has been a bullying type approach that you either accept it or we'll take you to the world court for trade barrier. And that doesn't go over very long, and at least once the countries can find an alternative source, they're going to move to it rather than be bullied into it.
Yeah, and it's kind of encouraging, at least, to see some of these countries taking a stand against GMOs.
It's not because of ideology. It's because they see the health effect.
Yes.
And if you, and that's the whole thing on labeling, isn't because of cost or anything else, as the legal review on H.R. 1599 shows. There's no cost factor really involved in it at all. It's strictly to prevent the accumulation of data on adverse events. In other words, so that there isn't a control group that you can point to like we had for tobacco, and say, well, here's a non-GMO versus a GMO, and look at the difference in health status of the children and the family. As long as you have contamination of 80 or 85% of all of your food products with those toxins, you're not going to have a control group to identify against. In fact, that's one of the things that's been documented now, is that in many of the commercial studies where they've had a control group, control fed rats and their test rats with the genetic engineering, that in their control diets, they also included the genetically engineered crops and glyphosate and a number of other things, so that it was really a farce from a scientific standpoint.
Yes. Let's go back to the H.R. 1599. I will post, there's a document called the Legal Analysis of H.R. 1599, an act to preempt state GMO disclosure laws. And if any of our listeners are interested in reading this, quite interesting to know exactly what this would entail. And I'll post a link to that on our show. I personally watched the hearing in the House. It was available online, and it was really disheartening to hear some of our representatives stand up and say there's been no studies that prove that GMOs have any ill health effects. I mean, it was just crazy because, as you said, there's many studies out there.
Well, it's been probably the greatest scientific fraud that's ever been perpetrated, if you read Steve Drucker's book, since The Piltdown Man.
Yeah, and I highly recommend that our listeners read that book. It's called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, and it's not only very factual, but it's a very interesting read and reads somewhat like a novel, but it's all based on fact.
And now you also find many of those people who've been so outspoken in how safe either glyphosate is or the genetically engineered foods, how for years now they've claimed total independence and no tie to the industry, that now with the release of their emails, how they've been getting paid and have a free slush fund with no strings attached to pretty much denigrate anyone who challenges the safety of GMOs or questions their virtues in any way. One of those, you see, with Kevin Folta, University of Florida, and how he has been so outspoken and very vitriolic against all of the legitimate GMO researchers for publishing their data. And here he's just been shown to have a $25,000 slush fund and be flown to Hawaii and around the country just to challenge, confuse the public on the safety of GMOs.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that some scientists can be bought, but as we know, they can. And Kevin Folta has been called out.
I guess one of the sad things is that the University of Florida has even said that he speaks for them and they'll defend him.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of universities that are going that way, but it's really kind of sad. And my concern is that these crops have been released into our food supply. And I just wonder how difficult it will be to reverse the effects. And this food that is in our mainstream grocery store to the tune of 80 to 85%. And also what it's doing to the soil.
Well, they've certainly done a thorough job pretty much of contaminating everything that they can. But it's not irreversible, but it's going to take some time. And we have our whole production system now that is shifted to be dependent on it, so that it puts our growers in a real bind and vulnerable position to have to shift if they have to do it overnight. And yet, from a safety standpoint, from a benefit standpoint, that's what has to happen if we're going to get on top of it. And the sooner the better.
Well, with the lawsuit that Drucker's organization and several scientists and others filed against the FDA, which they lost that suit, it basically said that it was illegal for the FDA to release them onto the market. I was just thinking, the judge that was assigned to this case, had she ruled in favor of them, that would have been a game changer.
Right.
They would have had to pull, they would have had to pull all this food from the market. That would have been incredible.
Certainly, if you challenged it today on the basis of formaldehyde, I don't know that there are any or very many tolerance levels for formaldehyde in our food, because generally it just doesn't occur. It's at such a low level and such a transient concentration that it's very difficult to even analyze and find it. But now we do find it. We're finding it fairly commonly in our food, and it probably explains why, or may explain at least, why in the Cirillini study he had the same response of the rats as far as kidney failure and liver toxicity, and also the tumorigenesis, the throwing of the breast tumors in his animals that were just fed the genetically engineered plants, as well as those that were fed the glyphosate at parts per billion in their water. And he got the same response from both as far as the health effects. Oh, we could anticipate that from other studies, laboratory studies, and that on tissue with the glyphosate. But people questioned was, well, how does the genetic engineering do the same thing? Well, that's where Shiva Iyaderi's research comes into play, showing that very potent carcinogen that accumulates then in the food as a result of the genetic engineering process itself. So it's producing it, it's there, and as we connect the dots, everything fits together very closely.
Yeah. So how do you think we're going to turn this around?
Education is the first thing. Labeling would be a tremendous help, because people then would have a choice, and they could vote with their dollars and also with their health. So that a farmer is going to produce what the customer wants if the customer knows to ask for it. If they don't have any choice, which is the situation now, then there's no record of the adverse effects and damage that's being done, as well as no choice for the individual unless they go organic. Organic's the one choice that we do have, but it's not accessible to everybody, either from a cost standpoint or from a just availability standpoint, where with labeling that would increase the ability to choose, and the market will respond.
I agree. I heard Andrew Kimbrell of the Center for Food Safety speak not too long ago, about the labeling issue, and he said it's as simple as this. If the consumer will see a label that says, you know, may contain or does contain genetically modified ingredients, even if they're not really aware of all, you know, the health effects of genetic engineering, they know there might be some inherent risk. So if they look at that and they see the two products and they go, okay, well, there's really no nutritional benefit here. And so, and there's a little bit of a risk in the GMO product, they're going to choose the conventional product over that. And that, I think that the biotech industry knows this, which is why they spend millions of dollars fighting this labeling.
I agree. And it's also from a liability standpoint, because our health is deteriorating very drastically in the United States, especially in our young people. That's our next generation, and we'll see this effect not just now, but in generations to come. So that there's a liability factor, just like we saw with the tobacco industry. And with the tobacco industry, you had a control group that you could tie into as far as those health aspects. And we're getting that now with the genetic engineering. But once that's established through labeling, I think it'll be a very short time before we lose the potential of the technology. As one scientist, University of California, commented, the greatest threat to genetic engineering is genetic engineering. In other words, the damage that they're doing now, when it really becomes apparent to people, will make it so that if we ever learn how to use it properly, that no one will want to, because it will be tainted so badly and so much damage has been done that the liability issue will preclude our ever having an opportunity to use that science when it's understood.
That's a very good point. And, you know, it's affecting the health of so many people. I mean, we look at the number of diseases that are ever increasing, including autism, which there have been some studies with the correlation between glyphosate and autism. It's really sad. And if we continue on this track, you know, we may end up with a situation where there's children in this country. I think I heard a figure like one out of every two children may have some autistic symptoms.
When you deprive the body of essential nutrients and then you change that entire gut microflora from a beneficial one to an antagonistic one, as you do with glyphosate at very low levels, you change the whole understanding or the whole response to over 32 diseases. And the correlation coefficient is pretty remarkable for all of those diseases with the genetic engineering and glyphosate. So they all have, or they may have, some contributing factors, and most of those will synergize with it. But you see a critical component and a common denominator with the GMO feed and food and the glyphosate chelating and antibiotic effect.
Like you said, unfortunately, it's really affecting the children, and will affect the children's children.
Right.
Well, so thank you so much, Dr. Huber, for this great conversation today and this information. And we're really excited and looking forward to hearing about your continued research in the area of infertility, and I think this is really important work and can't wait until it's completed to hear more about this.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity and the call here. I'm trying to be more of a facilitator since I'm emeritus professor now and don't have that opportunity to spend time in my own lab, but I appreciate so many others that give me an opportunity to tie in with their research and keep me informed of what they're doing. There's some really dedicated people.
Right, and I would include you in that group because you're doing amazing work and still speaking all over the country and probably abroad. And I just think that what you have to offer is so valuable. And it truly is an honor to speak with you again today, Dr. Huber.
Well, appreciate your support and sharing the word. Thanks, Carol.
Thank you again so much for being a guest on our show, and we'll be back next week with another great show.